Yes, indeed, those lawns and gardens can be a challenge with snow on them. We'll talk about that, among other things. Good Saturday morning to you, Denny Long, back with our Smart Garden Show. And helping you out this morning, Julie Weisenhorn from the U of M, John Traffy from the U of M, our turf guru, our turf expert. Good morning, Julie and John.
Hey, good morning, Denny.
Good morning.
Hi, John. I was mentioning to you early off air that we're already getting questions, lawn questions. I guess some folks are as shocked as I am, but we have other ones as well. If you have any kind of a lawn or garden question, and if you're a regular listener to the show, you know how busy we get. So call us or text us just as soon as you come up with your lawn or garden question, 651-461-9226. My question, with this snow on the lawn, John, are the seedlings now? I'm getting some, you know, the dormant seeds are actually coming up. They're looking pretty good. Now, are they in trouble with this, this 30, 31, 32 degree temperatures?
Probably not. I think, you know, this wouldn't be the first spring ever where we get, you know, some late snowfall on any kind of seedlings. You know, I'm sure a lot of people are hoping that the snow or cold temps are helping set back any crabgrass that may have germinated as well. But, you know, it's a little bit of a wash as far as what's going to how much that's actually going to affect the seedlings. But more often than not, you're probably going to be just fine.
I would assume that given our, you know, 80 degree temp and we've had some warm weather, that even though the thermometer may say 32 degrees, that doesn't mean the soil is 32, right?
That's a really great point. So the soil is going to hold on to a lot more, a lot higher temperatures than the air will. It's just not going to go up or going to go down quite as fast as what the air temperatures do. So it's kind of lagging behind. So we've got a little bit warmer soil temperatures, and you know, things are slowly warming up despite what the air is doing.
Okay. This listener, Julian John, says this. They have some bare spots in their yard where they want to plant clover. Now, is there a difference between a low clover and a taller clover? And the clover starts spreading once it takes hold in the yard. Okay, that kind of runs together. I'm not sure what they're asking, I'll tell you the truth. What about the difference in the low clover and taller clover? I'm not sure what they're asking.
I think it's white clover and red clover.
Okay.
Yeah, or it could be referring to a micro clover, which are being marketed for lawns. And the truth is that kind of the spoiler alert, at least from what we've seen from research, is that the micro clovers are going to, they're really just a small growing variety of white clover or Dutch white clover. Generally, from what we've noticed, is that they revert back to like a wild type of just a normal Dutch white clover. But you could certainly seed white clover really at any time if you're looking to do that, but it doesn't take very much seed. I would avoid from overdoing it for trying to seed an area. You really need you know, a tenth of a pound or a quarter pound for most lawns of seed.
Okay. You know, I just had a thought, Julie and John, that we haven't done this in a long time, but we have new listeners constantly here on the show. We appreciate that. But, Julie, maybe you could not only reintroduce yourself, but tell us who John Trappi is.
Yeah, sure. So I am an extension horticulture educator. I cover things like general gardening practices, also landscape design, plant selection. I spend a lot of time talking to people about specific plants. One big project that I have been working on, along with John and our colleague Laura Irish Hansen, is our foodscape landscape that's out at the Meyer Center at the Minnesota Landscape Arboretum. And John is our turf and urban green space educator, and just super fun to work with. I really enjoy it. Aww. So glad that he's on our team, and I've known John for quite a few years, so it's great to have you on the team, John. Been on
for a while. Thanks, Julie.
Yeah, this is great to have you both on. A lot of good info here coming this morning, so take advantage of it. 651-461-9226. Let's grab a phone call this morning. Gary calling in from St. Louis Park, I believe. Gary, you're on CCO. Good morning. What is your question, please?
Hi, good morning, everybody. I have just a real quick question, and I'm wondering, when can I start to prune my evergreens?
So evergreens can be pruned throughout the season. For example, you could be pruning your arborvitae. You could prune your yews at this time. And you can also, if you're trying to control the size of a pine tree, for example, you know, they have little candles that grow. We call them candles. It's the new growth on the end of the stems. You can snap that off to help kind of curb the growing of that plant, the size of that plant. We don't really recommend it in general. It's a natural occurrence for that plant. We really do want it to get to be its full mature size. But sure, you can do junipers now. You can do arborvitae, and you can also do yews. And so there's some good information on our extension site on how to take care of evergreens, fertilize them. And that would be a good piece of advice as well.
Okay. Texter says this, can you put crabgrass and lawn food fertilizer down now?
You can. Right now, it really, I suppose, depends on where they're texting from. We have what's called a turf dashboard. If you just use your favorite search engine, you can find the turf dashboard to help find dashboard. If you just use your favorite search engine, you can find the turf dashboard to help find when is the best time to put down a crabgrass pre-emergent herbicide. And it'll basically just tell you, you can drop a pin, and it'll tell you if it's too early, too late, or the optimal time. About the lower third of the state of Minnesota is already getting to the point where it's probably too late to put down a crabgrass pre-emergent, but the upper two-thirds of the state is still within that optimal, or maybe even slightly too early, depending on where it's located.
All right.
Hey, John, what's your thought about weed and feed products?
Yeah, so crabgrass preventer is, a lot of times, the crabgrass preventer is combined with fertilizer where, you know, you're feeding your lawn at the same time as you're applying this crabgrass pre-emergent. That's a little bit different than the weed and feed products, which are combining a herbicide that's a post-emergent control with fertilizer. And generally, we try to avoid recommending those types of products. Because you're really adding a broad spectrum herbicide to the environment, regardless of what weed is there. The pre-emergents are a little bit more targeted. They're combined with the fertilizer, and a lot of times they're the only source of that crabgrass pre-emergent that's available for homeowners. So there's a slight distinction between a crabgrass preventer plus fertilizer versus a weed and feed product, which we generally don't recommend because they're not very effective at controlling weeds post-emergently with fertilizer.
The other day I was thinking about just regular lawn fertilizer, and I was thinking, should I or shouldn't I? And I recall that you and John and Julie and your colleagues say that, yeah, you could, but fall is really the optimum time. Is that correct?
Yeah, if you were to like think about it like a good, better, best type of scenario, the fall is the best time. Early fall, late fall is about the better time. Best time is early fall. Better is late fall, and good is about sometime in early spring. Depending on the amount of seeds and, you know, weed seeds and things like that you have growing in your lawn. But now can be acceptable, but I would wait just a couple more weeks until things green up just a little bit more.
All right. Let's do this. A quick break is in order. We'll invite our listeners to join in on the conversation. 651-461-9226. If you'd like to call and talk with Julie or John, or just send a text, whichever is easier, call, text 651-461-9226. Right now in the Twin Cities, 32, or at that 32-degree mark, we expect highs today near 49. We'll drop again to around 33 overnight, but sunshine returns tomorrow. We'll have a high of about 61. Right now, 32 on News Talk 830. This is WCCO. And good morning. Welcome back to our Smart Garden Show here every Saturday on CCO in the 8 o'clock hour. This morning, Julie Wisenhorn and John Traffy from the U of M. John, of course, joins us from time to time. Julie, we're both grateful for that. For any turf questions.
Definitely.
We're glad John's with, especially today. I'm looking at callers in Texas. We have many. Let's do this. Let's grab a call. Monica, I believe, is calling in from Bloomington this morning. Hi, Monica. What is your question, please?
Good morning. We have an ash tree that's on a slopey hill, and over the years, our dogs have run circles around that and exposed along that with the rain, have exposed the roots to that tree to maybe like 3-inch roots. And I'm wondering, I know we have to eventually put sod on there, but I'm wondering what is the best type of soil to put down there? Is it black dirt or topsoil? I really don't know the difference because we want to cover up those roots again before we lay any sod down.
So the best solution for that tree is mulching it, not sod, and not covering it with soil. So it may seem that plant is exposed, those roots, but if you cover it with mulch, that helps to protect them. And so you want to create at least a 6-foot diameter mulch ring around that tree. And that will do a couple of things. So mulch will protect the roots from traffic, from people walking on them. Mulch will also hold in moisture, and that's really important going forward, especially for this tree because it's on a slope, because it's subject to gravity and pulling that moisture down away from it. It will also look better. That's great. And it will also moderate soil temperatures. And this is really important, not only in the winter. We think of, you know, keeping our plants nice and cozy, but it actually helps to moderate the soil temperatures so that there's less shock to the plant as we go into these seasons like we're in now, where we have warm weather one weekend and cold weather the next weekend. And then in the summer, that mulch helps to keep the soil cooler, and so the tree is less stressed out. And that's important for ash trees in particular because they're susceptible to the emerald ash borer, and you do want to keep an eye out for issues with your ash tree. And you can find good information on our extension site about, you know, what you should be looking for. And then you make the decision if you're treating that tree against emerald ash borer or if you're going to replace it with another tree, remove it and replace it. So you can find that information on extension.umn.edu. So I, again, just to summarize, I'd recommend just mulching that tree and use wood mulch. That's a great addition to the landscape. And that should take care of it. You shouldn't have to add any more soil or do anything else, no sod or anything.
Julie, I'm looking at a text that came in a bit ago. This might be related. You might have the same answer. Good morning. It says, I recently removed some green ash trees from my property to make room for a shed that I plan to build. I suspect, Texas says, that they had been infested with emerald ash borer. How do I responsibly dispose of the logs?
That's a good question for our MDA, the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, which has an extensive webpage on emerald ash borer in particular, and does include information on disposal of that wood. So I would visit that site. It's just at MDA. I think it's just MDA.gov. Let me look that up real quickly.
Sure.
But so that would be, I'm glad that they wrote that in, because that's something that's really a responsible tree owner and a good way to look at that. So let me just find that. What's
sure.
Here?
While you're doing that, I want to alert our listeners that we'll have about another half hour of the show to go. Smart Garden Show, 651-461-9226, for a phone call or a text for Julie and John. What is, Julie, here's another question for you. What is the best, go ahead.
Oh, the website for the MDA is mda.state.mn.gov. .us, and you can put a /EAB.
All right. Good. Thanks for the follow-up on that.
Yep.
What is the best soil, the texter wants to know, for a raised garden? It's 12 inches deep, stands on legs above the ground.
Oh, nice. That's a great way to use some space and go vertical in your growing. You can use just a standard, there are raised bed mixes, really particular, but you can also use a standard potting soil. I like to look for a potting soil for raised beds that has a little bit more organic matter in it and less peat. Peat is also organic matter, but it's a little bit lighter growing medium. And I like to have something that's got a little bit more weight to it. So Go to your local garden center. I would talk to them about it. Depending on how big the raised bed is, you can either buy it in bulk or you can buy it in bags. Might be easier to handle it in bags. And so just take a look at the different kinds that they have and check with the staff there. We have really knowledgeable people in our garden centers here in Minnesota and in our green industry overall. So you should be able to find something that'll work out fine.
All right. One more question before we look at the weather. Should the hostas and lily of the valley be up yet?
Yeah, some of them are coming up. My hostas are poking out. Lily of the valley probably is. I think one thing to remember about these garden flowers and garden plants that we have is that they have become acclimated to the conditions. These are hardy plants. They've been going through the cycle that we have. And so we might be, you know, scared for those plants that they're going to get nipped or they're going to have a little, you know, some frost damage. They might see, you might see a little bit of that on the tips of the plants, but remember that they've been gradually coming out of dormancy over the time period. And so they're acclimating themselves to the conditions we have.
All right. Stand by, Julie and John, please. We'll take a break for weather and we'll be right back with the more Lawn and Garden Talk. 651-461-9226 for either a phone call or a text. Here on News Talk 830, this is WCCO. And good morning. Welcome back to our Smart Garden Show here every Saturday in the 8 o'clock hour. This morning, if you're just joining us, Julie Wisenhorn and John Trappi from the UFM answering any kind of a lawn or garden question you might have this morning. Julie and John, as usual, callers, texters to keep us busy the rest of the way here. In fact, let's grab the first caller, Jamie, I believe, calling in from Randolph this morning. Hi, Jamie. What is your question, please?
Yes, we planted Carl Forster grass in front of a privacy fence last spring, and it hasn't seemed to grow or grow out very much. Is it a slow-growing grass, or might we have planted a too small of a grass there?
Okay. It's actually a cool-season grass, so you should start to see it green up at the base. If you have not already, you should cut it back. And when you do that, just look down at the base of the plant. You'll probably start to see some green plants coming up, some blades. And you want to just cut above those. You don't want to cut those off because, of course, that's the part you're waiting for. But it should start showing up pretty quickly now. It could be that the fence is kind of protecting it and shading it a little bit. So that may be why it's a little bit later than maybe in a sunnier spot.
All right, very good. Thanks, Jamie. You know, I was thinking this personally now, this might be a good week because last week was a little busy. I want to head to the Arboretum because it's got to be such so many great things to see. But what's going on there, Julie? Do you have any idea?
Oh, my gosh. Visit the site, arb.umn.edu. There are so many events that are coming up, things like our market kind of a it's like a different vendors that we have, and they are going to start. They'll be down at the Margot Picnic Shelter area, and that starts next week. So there's the full pink moon hike. There's Arbor Day, May markets, discovery booths throughout the Arboretum, the plant sale. If you are looking for a great plant sale, and there are many of them. The Arboretum plant sale is in its 56th year of this plant sale. It is on May 10th and 11th, which is Mother's Day weekend, but not on Sunday. It's on Friday and Saturday this year. You do need tickets to get in. It's free admission. You just need to reserve your time, and that's to help manage the immense traffic that we have around around that day. There's Mother's Day picnic box lunches. We've got artists and music in the gardens. The Abiders are going to be at two of the sessions of Music in the Garden, so I hope people will come out and see us play. Oh, my gosh. Yoga retreats and Heroes to Hives beekeeping. It just goes on and on. So great events, something for everybody. And, again, it's at arb.umn.edu.
Yeah, get on there and secure a time, and it makes parking so much easier.
Yeah,
so
and easy. Now actually members do not need a ticket to get in Tuesdays, uh-huh. Wednesdays, and Thursdays.
So I can just pop over then.
Pop in right. And just scan your card at the Easy Pass lane.
Excellent. Thanks for letting us know about that. Yeah, great place. All right, back to our text, back to phone calls. In fact, let's grab that phone call first, and then we'll pick up on text questions. Cindy, I believe, calling in from Wilmer, Minnesota this morning. Hi, Cindy. What is your question?
Good morning. I have a question about treating ash trees. We have 7 ash trees on our property, and we're starting by treating 2 of the trees. And we had an arborist out here, and he is recommending a tree rescue system. And I'm wondering if you're familiar with this. This is a deep root watering system. It's actually a very simple system, not real expensive. But I guess my main question is it really necessary to have deep root watering to trees? And then I'll just add on to that. We're finding this treatment is very, very expensive. And is there somewhat of a guide to what to expect or what we should be paying for a treatment? And thank you very much. We love listening to your show.
Thank you.
Oh, that's great. Boy, that's a loaded question. Lots of information there. So it's great that you're treating your trees. Good that you're working with an arborist. That's wonderful. And a really good investment for your landscape. I'm not totally up on all of the different treatments that they use for emerald ash borer, but it sounds to me like they're doing what's called a soil drench. And this is where the pesticide is put down into the soil and it's taken up through the roots of the trees. And then it's transported throughout the entire plant. So as the emerald ash borer burrows into the bark and into the cambium layer of the plant, it will then, as it consumes it, as the larvae consume it, then it'll go ahead and kill the larvae at that point. So that's probably how it's working. There's also injections that arborists will do for trees as well. That's another type. One of the questions I would ask is how frequently do they need to do the soil drench? Sometimes I know that injections are usually every 2 years, and that would be one question because that, you know, probably has something to do with the cost. But also once you start treating that tree, you really need to continue to do it in order to prevent the emerald ash borer from taking up residence in your trees. The one question I would ask about soil drench and is that the pesticide that's in that soil drench is going to affect plants around that tree. For example, if you are using a neonicotinoid in that soil drench, which is a common systemic pesticide, that pesticide is going to be taken up by plants around the tree. So if you've planted pollinator plants around that area, and I want to say it's within 6 feet of the tree, then those plants could potentially take up that pesticide as well, which could be detrimental to bees. Just inquire about that. Look around your trees. Maybe they're in your lawn area. Note that as John was talking about, if you have Dutch white clover growing in your lawn or any other flowering plants that bees may feed on, you may want to remove those within this vicinity of the treatment just so that you're not transporting any of that pesticide through those flowers that bees might feed on. Great to work with your arborist and ask. You might want to ask those questions. Again, you can also visit the MDA website, the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and learn about other ways about, you know, good questions to ask about EAB.
Very good. Thanks, Cindy. 651-461-9226. Our phone number is also our text number. If you're just joining us, joining Julie Weisenhorn this morning, turf expert John Trappi from the U of M, if you have any particular lawn question. In fact, here's one, John. Texter says they have to see the boulevard because the drought killed grass, but crabgrass was rampant. Should I plant grass and forget about crab prevention or use the preventer, hoping there are a few blades of grass that survived, and plant grass late summer? What do you think of those questions?
That is a very good question.
Wow.
So in a really common scenario, for a boulevard. Regardless of what your strategy is this year, I would consider planting a more salt tolerant turfgrass like the fine fescues. They're going to be the best adapted for a boulevard where, you know, it's just excessive heat, drought, and salt stress on that area. So as far as what to do right now or this spring, you can take either strategy, but just know that if you do a crabgrass preventer, there's a good chance that, depending on which chemistry you use, that it will affect the fine fescue seeds or seedlings that you spread over the area. Personally, what I would do is just try to seed the fine fescue now and try to get something established. That way you have some cover there. But plan on also seeding again in the fall, because you're probably going to have some crabgrass and maybe some other annuals that emerge. You can try to treat them if you're comfortable enough with it using a post-emergent control product that is safe on the seedling, on the fine fescue seedlings. You could treat them in late May, early June, once you've mowed the fine fescues a couple of times. But again, try to keep some seed or order or purchase some extra seed and plan on seeding just a little bit more in the fall.
Okay. Julie, I'm looking at a text about some results from a U of M soil test. The results, the pH 7.6, organic matter 7, high phosphorus, very high, potassium, very high. Question is, should I add sulfur to reduce the pH in my perennial hosta garden?
So the pH is 7.6?
Yeah.
Well, that's not too bad. I'm going to turn this one over to our soil scientist, John.
Lowering pH is a lot more difficult than trying to raise it. So you may notice that for hydrangeas and other things where you can, for a very small area, sometimes lower or you can adjust the pH. But generally, we don't recommend it. Even 7.6 is high, but I wouldn't worry too much about it. There's a lot of other problems that come from trying to add sulfur to lower the pH. That would be what you could use. It's just some plants are sensitive to sulfur, and you can burn the plants. So most of the time, we just recommend just living with it. If it's not extreme, 8.5 or 9 for a pH, 7.6 isn't too bad. Soils naturally acidify over time, so I wouldn't worry. For a pH, 7.6 isn't too bad. Soils naturally acidify over time, so I wouldn't worry too much about it and just kind of live with it.
All right.
And hostas are tough plants. I would they're not sensitive to a low or high pH. They actually are very, very adaptable. So I wouldn't worry about it with your hostas.
Tell you what, I know we have to break momentarily, but I want to grab another phone call before we do that. Judy calling in from Clear Lake. Hi, Judy. What is your question?
Hi, and thank you for what you guys do and the information that you give. I have some plum trees. They're naturalized to my area, and they've stopped fruiting. And I'm wondering if I cut a main branch off one of the plum trees, will it stimulate new growth and lead to refruiting? And how else ways can I get an old plum to start refruiting?
Well, I think that I wouldn't prune anything off expecting that would help. That might actually hinder any further production. When people say that these have been fruiting shrubs or trees, and then they kind of have petered out. It could be a couple of things. One is that it could be that they're more shaded, that over the years a tree or nearby trees have grown and created a canopy over those plants, and they're getting less sun. Something else that might be happening is if there are fewer pollinators in the area to pollinate those plants, that could be affecting your fruiting as well. So maybe consider... Are there any pesticides being sprayed around the area? Have you seen a decrease in pollinators? How can you build that population by planting more pollinator-friendly plants around those trees? And then also thinking just about the age of the plant. Plants have a life cycle, and eventually they may die. And if they're really old, naturalized plums, could be that they're just coming to the end of their life cycle and they're not as productive as in the past. What I would do is I would get some new American plum trees. They're a native species here. You can order them from a native plant nursery, and I would start planting more of those to help fill in that area.
All right, very good. We need to take a quick break and come back with more answers to a bunch of questions here on our Smart Garden Show. 32 degrees here in the Twin Cities. What is our high today? Going to be near 49, but we'll warm up to 61 tomorrow after a 33 low overnight. Right now, 32 degrees here on News Talk A3O WCCO. Hey, good morning. Welcome back to the remaining moments of our Smart Garden Show here on CCO every Saturday in the 8 o'clock hour. This morning, if you just joined us, Julie Weisenhorn and John Trappi from the U of M are answering any particular lawn or garden question you might have. And because, what do they say, by popular demand, Julie and John will be back next Saturday. Mm-hmm. So I know we've got just a ton of questions we're never going to get to, and I apologize for that, but we're really, really busy today. And let's see how many folks we can help out before you go. But yeah, we'll get both Julie and John back next Saturday here on the show. Just a heads up there. John, a ton of questions about crabgrass. When to do it, how to do it. Give us the lowdown, please.
So crabgrass seedlings start to germinate anytime soil temperatures get up around 52 degrees Fahrenheit to 55 degrees. So we're right at that range right now for about the lower third of the state. So the best strategy with summer annual grasses like crabgrass is to use a pre-emergent herbicide to basically, as the seedlings germinate and emerge and they grow through this barrier that's been spread or sprayed across the surface of the soil, they will take in that herbicide and then they stop growing and they die. So the crabgrass pre-emergents are the best strategy. Right now, if you are in the lower third of the state, I would recommend any products containing thiopi, the active ingredient. That's the ibuprofen that we sometimes take with Advil. So not the trade name, but the active ingredient, because that'll have pre-emergent and post-emergent activity. Otherwise, there's plenty of other great resources tools out there that are also pre-emergent herbicides that can work as well.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Julie, how soon, Texter says, can we be uncovering our hostas from winter leaf cover?
Well, I'm a fan of just pushing the leaves aside. Those hostas are pretty strong, those sprouts, and they'll actually come up through the leaves. So unless you've got a foot of leaves on top of your garden, those hostas will come right through on their own, but you could just push them aside if you wish. I wouldn't do it this weekend. I'd wait, a couple days so it warms up.
Sure. This listener has three peony bushes they would like to transplant from a shaded area to a sunny area. Is that at all difficult and harmful to the plants? They've just begun to show a little new growth.
Yeah, I would hold off on that. Usually transplanting for peonies is later in the summer after they've bloomed. And right now, they have huge tuberous roots, and so you have to dig way, way, way down, and you have to replant them exactly at the same depth of the soil. So if you plant them deeper, they won't bloom, and they do take several years to recover from transplanting. So unless you truly have to transplant them, I would leave them where they are, especially if they're just showing new growth at this point.
I think we have time for one more, maybe two. Listener says, I removed an area of sod and dormant seeded with bee lawn seed and activated compost in November. This spring, when should I apply new seeds to overseed the areas where seed is coming out a bit thinner? Also, there are several anthills in the thin area.
Ooh, yeah. I would just try to be patient and see what comes up. You know, we're most of the grasses and the plants within the seeds within the bee lawn mix, those are going to may germinate and emerge at different times. So just try to be patient because you don't want to necessarily seed too high of a rate and then they crowd each other out. So try to be patient and give it a couple more weeks. And then I would look at doing it, maybe overseed any thin areas the first or second week of May.
Okay. We've got 60 seconds to go. Julie, I wanted to make mention, of course, head to the Arboretum. How do we find it online?
At arb.umn.edu. And if you did not get your questions answered, you can visit our extension site at extension.umn.edu. Go to Yard and Garden, and we have Ask a Master Gardener. You can enter in your question and submit up to 3 photos. Master Gardeners are ready to answer your questions.
Great website.
There's also a ton of information, too.
Yeah, extension.umn.edu. Another reminder, if you missed it, both Julie and John will be back next Saturday on our Smart Garden Show. So if you didn't get your question answered today, join us again next week. Julie and John, thanks so much. We will talk again next Saturday.
Thanks, Denny.
Thank you,
Always
Julie.
Always a lot of fun.
Thank you, John. Always is. Thanks for the information. Stay tuned next for our news break, and then Andy Lindis will be answering any kind of a home improvement question you might have on our home improvement show coming along next hour. By the way, our high today, we're going to only reach about 49 degrees. We drop again to 33 overnight, 61 with sunny skies tomorrow. We'll get you further details coming up. 32 now on CCO. Yes, indeed, those lawns and gardens can be a challenge with snow on them. We'll talk about that, among other things. Good Saturday morning to you, Denny Long, back with our Smart Garden Show. And helping you out this morning, Julie Weisenhorn from the U of M, John Traffy from the U of M, our turf guru, our turf expert. Good morning, Julie and John.
Hey, good morning, Denny.
Good morning.
Hi, John. I was mentioning to you early off air that we're already getting questions, lawn questions. I guess some folks are as shocked as I am, but we have other ones as well. If you have any kind of a lawn or garden question, and if you're a regular listener to the show, you know how busy we get. So call us or text us just as soon as you come up with your lawn or garden question, 651-461-9226. My question, with this snow on the lawn, John, are the seedlings now? I'm getting some, you know, the dormant seeds are actually coming up. They're looking pretty good. Now, are they in trouble with this 30, 31, 32 degree temperatures?
Probably not. I think, you know, this wouldn't be the first spring ever where we get, you know, some late snowfall on any kind of seedlings. You know, I'm sure a lot of people are hoping that the snow or cold temps are helping set back any crabgrass that may have germinated as well. But, you know, it's a little bit of a little bit of a wash as far as what's going to how much that's actually going to affect the seedlings. But more often than not, you're probably going to be just fine.
I would assume that given our, you know, 80 degree temp and we've had some warm weather, that even though the thermometer may say 32 degrees, that doesn't mean the soil is 32, right?
That's a really great point. So the soil is going to hold on to a lot more, a lot higher temperatures than the air will. It's just not going to go up or going to go down quite as fast as what the air temperatures do. So it's kind of lagging behind. So we've got a little bit warmer soil temperatures, and you know, things are slowly warming up despite what the air is doing.
Okay. This listener, Julie and John, says this. They have some bare spots in their yard where they want to plant clover. Now, is there a difference between a low clover and a taller clover? And the clover starts spreading once it takes hold in the yard. Okay, that kind of runs together. I'm not sure what they're asking. I'll tell you the truth. What about the difference in the low clover and taller clover? I'm not sure what they're asking.
I think it's white clover and red clover.
Okay.
Yeah, or it could be referring to a micro clover, which are currently being marketed for lawns. And the truth is that kind of the spoiler alert, at least from what we've seen from research, is that the micro clovers are going to, they're really just a small growing variety of white clover or Dutch white clover. Generally, from what we've noticed, is that they revert back to like a wild type of just a normal Dutch white clover. But you could certainly seed white clover really at any time if you're looking to do that, but it doesn't take very much seed. I would avoid from overdoing it for trying to seed an area. You really need a tenth of a pound or a quarter pound for most lawns of seed.
Okay. You know, I just had a thought, Julie and John, that we haven't done this in a long time, but we have new listeners constantly here on the show. We appreciate that. But, Julie, maybe you could not only reintroduce yourself, but tell us who John Trappi is.
Yeah, sure. So I am an extension horticulture educator. I cover things like general gardening practices, also landscape design, plant selection. I spend a lot of time talking to people about specific plants. One big project that I have been working on, along with John and our colleague Laura Irish Hansen, is our foodscape landscape that's out at the Meyer Center at the Minnesota Landscape Arboretum. And John is our turf and urban green space educator, and just super fun to work with. I really enjoy it. Aww. So glad that he's on our team, and I've known John for quite a few years, so it's great to have you on the team, John.
Been on for a while. Thanks, Julie.
Yeah, this is great to have you both on. A lot of good info here coming this morning, so take advantage of it. 651-461-9226. Let's grab a phone call this morning. Gary calling in from St. Louis Park, I believe. Gary, you're on CCO. Good morning. What is your question, please?
Hi, good morning, everybody. I have a real quick question, and I'm wondering, when can I start to prune my evergreens?
So evergreens can be pruned throughout the season. For example, you could be pruning your arborvitae. You could prune your yews at this time. And you can also, if you're trying to control the size of a pine tree, for example, you know, they have little candles that grow. We call them candles. It's the new growth on the end of the stems. You can snap that off to help kind of curb the growing of that plant, the size of that plant. We don't really recommend it. In general, it's a natural occurrence for that plant. We really do want it to get to be its full mature size. But sure, you can do junipers now. You can do arborvitae, and you can also do yews. And so there's some good information on our extension site on how to take care of evergreens, fertilize them. And that would be a good piece of advice as well.
Okay. Texter says this, can you put crabgrass and lawn food fertilizer down now?
You can. Right now, it really, I suppose, depends on where they're texting from. We have what's called a turf dashboard. If you just use your favorite search engine, you can find the turf dashboard to help find dashboard. If you just use your favorite search engine, you can find the turf dashboard to help find when is the best time to put down a crabgrass pre-emergent herbicide. And it'll basically just tell you, you can drop a pin, and it'll tell you if it's too early, too late, or the optimal time. About the lower third of the state of Minnesota is already getting to the point where it's probably too late to put down a crabgrass pre-emergent. But the upper two-thirds of the state is still within that optimal, or maybe even slightly too early, depending on where it's located.
All right.
Hey, John, what's your thought about weed and feed products?
Yeah, so crabgrass preventer is, a lot of times, the crabgrass preventer is combined with fertilizer where, you know, you're feeding your lawn at the same time as you're applying this crabgrass pre-emergent. That's a little bit different than the weed and feed products, which are combining a herbicide that's a post-emergent control with fertilizer. And generally, we try to avoid recommending those types of products. Because you're really adding a broad-spectrum herbicide to the environment, regardless of what weed is there. The pre-emergents are a little bit more targeted. They're combined with the fertilizer, and a lot of times they're the only source of that crabgrass pre-emergent that's available for homeowners. So there's a slight distinction between a crabgrass preventer plus fertilizer versus a weed and feed product, which we generally don't recommend because they're not very effective at controlling weeds post-emergently with fertilizer.
The other day I was thinking about just regular lawn fertilizer, and I was thinking, should I or shouldn't I? And I recall that you and John and Julie and your colleagues say that, yeah, you could, but fall is really the optimum time. Is that correct?
Yeah, if you were to like think about it like a good, better, best type of scenario, the fall is the best time. Early fall, late fall is about the better time, And, excuse me, best time is early fall. Better is late fall. And good is about sometime in early spring. Especially depending on the amount of seeds and, you know, weed seeds and things like that you have growing in your lawn. But now can be acceptable. But I would wait just a couple more weeks until things green up just a little bit more.
All right. Let's do this. A quick break is in order. We'll invite our listeners to join in on the conversation. 651-461-9226. If you'd like to call and talk with Julie or John, or just send a text, whichever is easier, call, text 651-461-9226. Right now in the Twin Cities, 32, or right at that 32-degree mark. We expect highs today near 49. We'll drop again to around 33 overnight, but sunshine returns tomorrow. We'll have a high of about 61. Right now, 32 on News Talk 830. This is WCCO. And good morning. Welcome back to our Smart Garden Show here every Saturday on CCO in the 8 o'clock hour. This morning, Julie Wisenhorn and John Traffy from the U of M. John, of course, joins us from time to time. Julie, we're both grateful for that. For any turf questions.
Definitely.
We're glad John's with, especially today. I'm looking at callers in Texas. We have many. Let's do this. Let's grab a call. Monica, I believe, is calling in from Bloomington this morning. Hi, Monica. What is your question, please?
Good morning. We have an ash tree that's on a slopey hill, and over the years our dogs have run circles around that and exposed along that with the rain, have exposed the roots to that tree to maybe like 3-inch roots. And I'm wondering, I know we have to eventually put sod on there, but I'm wondering what is the best type of soil to put down there? Is it black dirt or topsoil? I really don't know the difference because we want to cover up those roots again before we lay any sod down.
So the best solution for that tree is mulching it, not sod, and not covering it with soil. So it may seem that plant is exposed, those roots, but if you cover it with mulch, that helps to protect them. And so you want to create at least a 6-foot diameter mulch ring around that tree. And that will do a couple of things. So mulch will protect the roots from traffic, from people walking on them. Mulch will also hold in moisture, and that's really important going forward, especially for this tree because it's on a slope, because it's subject to gravity and pulling that moisture down away from it. It will also look better. That's great. And it will also moderate soil temperatures. And this is really important, not only in the winter. We think of, you know, keeping our plants nice and cozy, but it actually helps to moderate the soil temperatures so that there's less shock to the plant as we go into these seasons like we're in now, where we have warm weather one weekend and cold weather the next weekend. And then in the summer, that mulch helps to keep the soil cooler, and so the tree is less stressed out. And that's important for ash trees in particular because they're susceptible to the emerald ash borer. And you do want to keep an eye out for issues with your ash tree. And you can find good information on our extension site about, you know, what you should be looking for. And then you make the decision if you're treating that tree against emerald ash borer or if you're going to replace it with another tree, remove it and replace it. So you can find that information on extension.umn.edu. So I, again, just to summarize, I'd recommend just mulching that tree and use wood mulch. That's a great addition to the landscape, and that should take care of it. You shouldn't have to add any more soil or do anything else, no sod or anything.
Julie, I'm looking at a text that came in a bit ago. This might be related. You might have the same answer. Good morning. It says, I recently removed some green ash trees from my property to make room for a shed that I plan to build. I suspect, Texas says, that they had been infested with emerald ash borer. How do I responsibly dispose of the logs?
That's a good question for our MDA, the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, which has an extensive webpage on emerald ash borer in particular, and does include information on disposal of that wood. So I would visit that site. It's just at MDA. I think it's just MDA.gov. Let me look that up real quickly.
Sure.
But, yeah, so that would be, I'm glad that they wrote that in. because that's something that's really a responsible tree owner and a good good way to look at that. So let me just find that website here.
While you're doing that, I want to alert our listeners that we'll have about another half hour of the show to go. Smart Garden Show, 651-461-9226 for a phone call or a text for Julie and John. What is, Julie, here's another question for you. What is the best, go ahead.
Oh, the website for the MDA is mda.state.mn.us. And you can put a /EAB.
All right. Good. Thanks for the follow-up on that.
Yep.
What is the best soil? The texter wants to know. For a raised garden, it's 12 inches deep, stands on legs above the ground.
Oh, nice. That's a great way to use some space and go vertical in your growing. You can use just a standard. There are raised bed mixes, really particular, but you can also use a standard potting soil. I like to look for a potting soil for raised beds that has a little bit more organic matter in it and less peat. Peat is also organic matter, but it's a lighter, a little bit lighter growing medium. And I like to have something that's got a little bit more weight to it. So go to your local garden center. I would talk to them about it. Depending on how big the raised bed is, you can either buy it in bulk or you can buy it in bags. Might be easier to handle it in bags. And so just take a look at the different kinds that they have and check with the staff there. We have really knowledgeable people in our garden centers here in Minnesota and in our green industry overall. So you should be able to find something that'll work out fine.
All right. One more question before we look at the weather. Should the hostas and lily of the valley be up yet?
Yeah, some of them are coming up. My hostas are poking out. Lily of the valley probably is. I think one thing to remember about these garden flowers and garden plants that we have is that they have become acclimated to the conditions. These are hardy plants. They've been going through the cycle that we have. And so we might be, you know, scared for those plants that they're going to get nipped or they're going to have a little, you know, some frost damage. They might see, you might see a little bit of that on the tips of the plants. But remember that they've been gradually coming out of dormancy over the time period, and so they're acclimating themselves to the conditions we have.
All right. All right, stand by, Julie and John, please. We'll take a break for weather, and we'll be right back with the more Lawn and Garden Talk, 651-461-9226, either a phone call or a text. Here on News Talk 830, this is WCCO. And good morning. Welcome back to our Smart Garden Show here every Saturday in the 8 o'clock hour. This morning, if you're just joining us, Julie Wisenhorn and John Trappi from the UFM answering any kind of a lawn or garden question you might have this morning. Julie and John, as usual, callers, texters to keep us busy the rest of the way here. In fact, let's grab the first caller, Jamie, I believe, calling in from Randolph this morning. Hi, Jamie. What is your question, please?
Yes, we planted Carl Forster grass in front of a privacy fence last spring, and it hasn't seemed to grow or grow out very much. Is it a slow-growing grass, or might we have planted too small of a grass there?
Okay. It's actually a cool-season grass, so you should start to see it green up at the base. If you have not already, you should cut it back. And when you do that, just look down at the base of the plant. You'll probably start to see some green plants coming up, some blades. And you want to just cut above those. You don't want to cut those off because, of course, that's part you're waiting for. But it should start showing up pretty quickly now. It could be that the fence is kind of protecting it and shading it a little bit. So that may be why it's a little bit later than maybe in a sunnier spot.
All right, very good. Thanks, Jamie. You know, I was thinking this personally now, this might be a good week because last week was a little busy. I want to head to the Arboretum because it's got to be so many great things to see. But what's going on there, Julie? Do you have any idea?
Oh my gosh. Visit the site, arb.umn.edu. There are so many events that are coming up. Things like our market, kind of a, it's like a different vendors that we have. And they are going to start, they'll be down at the Margot Picnic Shelter area. And that starts next week. So there's the full moon, full pink moon hike. There's Arbor Day, May markets, discovery booths throughout the Arboretum, the plant sale. If you are looking for a great plant sale, and there are many of them. The Arboretum plant sale is in its 56th year of this plant sale. It is on May 10th and 11th, which is Mother's Day weekend, but not on Sunday. It's on Friday and Saturday this year. You do need tickets to get in. It's free admission. You just need to reserve your time, and that's to help manage the immense traffic that we have around the around that day. There's Mother's Day picnic box lunches. We've got artists and music in the gardens. The Abiders are going to be at two of the sessions of Music in the Garden, so I hope people will come out and see us play. Oh my gosh, yoga retreats and Heroes to Hives beekeeping. It just goes on and on. So great events, something for everybody. And again, it's at arb.umn.edu.
Yeah, get on there and secure a time, and it makes parking so much easier.
Yeah,
so
and now actually members do not need a ticket to get in Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays.
So I can just pop over then.
Pop in and just scan your card at the Easy Pass lane.
Excellent. Thanks for letting us know about that. Yeah, great place. All right. Back to our text, back to phone calls. In fact, let's grab that phone call first, and then we'll pick up on text questions. Cindy, I believe, calling in from Wilmer, Minnesota this morning. Hi, Cindy. What is your question?
Good morning. I have a question about treating ash trees. We have 7 ash trees on our property, and we're starting by treating 2 of the trees. And we had an arborist out here, and he is recommending tree rescue system, and I'm wondering if you're familiar with this. This is a deep root watering system. It's actually a very simple system, not real expensive. But I guess my main question is it really necessary to have deep root watering to trees? And then I'll just add on to that. We're finding this treatment is very, very expensive. And is there somewhat of a guide to what to expect or what we should be paying for a treatment? And thank you very much. We appreciate, we love listening to your show.
Thank you.
Oh, that's great. Boy, that's a loaded question. Lots of information there. So it's great that you're treating your trees. Good that you're working with an arborist. That's wonderful. And a really good investment for your landscape. I'm not totally up on all of the different treatments that they use for emerald ash borer, but it sounds to me like they're doing what's called a soil drench. And this is where the pesticide is put down into the soil and it's taken up through the roots of the trees. And then it's transported throughout the entire plant. So as the emerald ash borer burrows into the bark and into the cambium layer of the plant, it will then, as it consumes it, as the larvae consume it, then it'll go ahead and kill the larvae at that point. So that's probably how it's working. There's also injections that arborists will do for trees as well. That's another type. One of the questions I would ask is how frequently do they need to do the soil drench? Sometimes I know that injections are usually every 2 years, and that would be one question because that, you know, probably has something to do with the cost. But also once you start treating that tree, you really need to continue to do it in order to prevent the emerald ash borer from taking up residence in your trees. The one question I would ask about soil drench and is that how the pesticide that's in that soil drench is going to affect plants around that tree. For example, if you are using a neonicotinoid in that soil drench, which is a common systemic pesticide, that pesticide is going to be taken up by plants around the tree. So if you've planted pollinator plants around that area, and I think it's within 6 feet of the tree, then those plants could potentially take up that pesticide as well, which could be detrimental to bees. Just inquire about that. Look around your trees. Maybe they're in your lawn area. Note that as John was talking about, if you have Dutch white clover growing in your lawn or any other flowering plants that bees may feed on, you may want to remove those within this vicinity of the treatment, just so that you're not transporting any of that pesticide through those flowers that bees might feed on. All so right. Great to work with your arborist and ask. You might want to ask those questions. Again, you can also visit the MDA website, the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and learn about other ways about, you know, good questions to ask about EAB.
Very good. Thanks, Cindy. 651-461-9226. Our phone number is also our text number. If you're just joining us, joining Julie Weisenhorn this morning, turf expert John Trappe from the U of M, if you have any particular lawn question. In fact, here's one, John. Texter says they have to see the boulevard because the drought killed grass, but crabgrass was rampant. Should I plant grass and forget about crab prevention, or use the preventer, hoping there are a few blades of grass that survived, and plant grass late summer? What do you think of those questions?
That is a very good question.
Wow.
So, in a really common scenario for you know, for a boulevard, regardless of what your strategy is this year, I would consider planting a more salt tolerant turf grass like the fine fescues. They're going to be the best adapted for a boulevard where, you know, it's just excessive heat, drought, and salt stress on that area. So as far as what to do right now or this spring, you can take either strategy, but just know that if you do a crabgrass preventer, you know, there's a good chance that, depending on which chemistry you use, that it will affect the fine fescue seeds or seedlings that you spread over the area. Personally, what I would do is just try to seed the fine fescue now, and try to get something established. That way you have some cover there. But plan on also seeding again in the fall, because you're probably going to have some crabgrass and maybe some other annuals that emerge. You can try to treat them if you're comfortable enough with it, using a post-emergent control product that is safe on the seedling, on the fine fescue seedlings. You could treat them in late May, early June, once you've mowed the fine fescues a couple of times. But again, try to keep some seed or order or purchase some extra seed and plan on seeding just a little bit more in the fall.
Okay. Julie, I'm looking at a text about some results from a U of M soil test. The results, the pH 7.6, organic matter 7, high phosphorus very high, potassium very high. Question is, should I add sulfur to reduce the pH in my perennial hosta garden?
So the pH is 7.6?
Yeah.
Well, that's not too bad. I'm going to turn this one over to our soil scientist, John.
Lowering pH is a lot more difficult than trying to raise it. So you may notice that for hydrangeas and other things where you can, for a very small area, sometimes lower, or you can adjust the pH. But generally, we don't recommend it. Even 7.6 is high, but I wouldn't worry too much about it. There's a lot of other problems that come from trying to add sulfur to lower the pH. That would be what you could use. It's just some plants are sensitive to sulfur, and you can burn the plants. So most of the time, we just recommend just living with it. If it's not extreme, you know, 8.5 or 9 for a pH, 7.6 isn't too bad. Soils naturally acidify over time, so I wouldn't worry for a pH. 7.6 isn't too bad. Soils naturally acidify over time, so I wouldn't worry too much about it and just kind of live with it.
All right.
And hostas are tough plants. I would they're not sensitive to a low or high pH. They actually are very, very adaptable. So I wouldn't worry about it with your hostas.
Tell you what, I know we have to break momentarily, but I want to grab another phone call before we do that. Judy calling in from Clear Lake. Hi, Judy. What is your question?
Hi, and thank you for what you guys do and the information that you give. I have some plum trees. They're naturalized to my area, and they've stopped fruiting. And I'm wondering if I cut a main branch off one of the plum trees, will it stimulate new growth and lead to refruiting? And how else ways can I get an old plum to start refruiting?
Well, I think that I wouldn't prune anything off expecting that that would help. That might actually hinder any further production. When people say that these have been fruiting shrubs or trees, and then they kind of have petered out, it could be a couple of things. One is that it could be that they're more shaded, that over the years a tree or nearby trees have grown and created a canopy over those plants, and they're getting less sun. Something else that might be happening is if there are fewer pollinators in the area to pollinate those plants, that could be affecting your fruiting as well. So maybe consider, are there any pesticides being sprayed around the area? Have you seen a decrease in pollinators? How can you build that population by planting more pollinator-friendly plants around those trees? And then also thinking just about the age of the plant. Plants have a life cycle and eventually they may die. And if they're really old, naturalized plums, it could be that they're just coming to the end of their life cycle and they're not as productive as in the past. What I would do is I would get some new American plum trees. They're a native species here. You can order them from a native plant nursery, and I would start planting more of those to help fill in that area.
All right, very good. We need to take a quick break and come back with more answers to a bunch of questions here on our Smart Garden Show. 32 degrees here in the Twin Cities. What is our high today? Going to be near 49, but we'll warm up to 61 tomorrow after a 33 low overnight. Right now, 32 degrees here on News Talk A3O WCCO. Hey, good morning. Welcome back to the remaining moments of our Smart Garden Show here on CCO every Saturday in the 8 o'clock hour. This morning, if you just joined us, Julie Weisenhorn and John Trappi from the U of M are answering any particular lawn or garden question you might have. And because, what do they say, by popular demand, Julie and John will be back next Saturday. Mm-hmm. So I know we've got just a ton of questions we're never going to get to, and I apologize for that, but we're really, really busy today. And let's see how many folks we can help out before you go. But yeah, we'll get both Julie and John back next Saturday here on the show. Just a heads up there. John, a ton of questions about crabgrass. When to do it, how to do it. Give us the lowdown, please.
So crabgrass seedlings start to germinate anytime soil temperatures get up around 52 degrees Fahrenheit to 55 degrees. So we're right at that range right now for about the lower third of the state. So the best strategy with summer annual grasses like crabgrass is to use a pre-emergent herbicide to as the seedlings germinate and emerge and they grow through this barrier that's been spread or sprayed across the surface of the soil, they will take in that herbicide and then they stop growing and they die. So the crabgrass pre-emergents are the best strategy. Right now, if you are in the lower third of the state, I would recommend that any products containing thiope, the active ingredient, that's the ibuprofen that we sometimes take with Advil. So not the trade name, but the active ingredient, because that'll have pre-emergent and post-emergent activity. Otherwise, there's plenty of other great resources tools out there that are also pre-emergent herbicides that can work as well.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Julie, how soon, Texter says, can we be uncovering our hostas from winter leaf cover?
Well, I'm a fan of just pushing the leaves aside. Those hostas are pretty strong, those sprouts, and they'll actually come up through the leaves. So unless you've got a foot of leaves on top of your garden, those hostas will come right through on their own, but you could just push them aside if you wish. I wouldn't do it this weekend. I'd wait, a couple days so it warms up.
Sure. This listener has three peony bushes they would like to transplant from a shaded area to a sunny area. Is that at all difficult and harmful to the plants? They've just begun to show a little new growth.
Yeah, I would hold off on that. Usually transplanting for peonies is later in the summer after they've bloomed. And right now, they have huge tuberous roots, and so you have to dig way, way, way down, and you have to replant them exactly at the same depth of the soil. So if you plant them deeper, they won't bloom, and they do take several years to recover from transplanting. So unless you truly have to transplant them, I would leave them where they are, especially if they're just showing new growth at this point.
I think we have time for one more, maybe two. Listener says, I removed an area of sod in dormant seeded with bee lawn seed and activated compost in November. This spring, when should I apply new seeds to overseed the areas where seed is coming out a bit thinner? Also, there are several anthills in the thin area.
Ooh, yeah. I would just try to be patient and see what comes up. You know, we're most of the grasses and the plants within the seeds within the bee lawn mix, those are going to may germinate and emerge at different times. So just try to be patient, because you don't want to necessarily seed too high of a rate and then they crowd each other out. So try to be patient and give it a couple more weeks, and then I would look at doing it, you know, maybe overseed any thin areas the first or second week of May.
Okay. We've got 60 seconds to go. Julie, I wanted to make mention, of course, head to the Arboretum. How do we find it online?
At arb.umn.edu. And if you did not get your questions answered, you can visit our extension site at extension.umn.edu. Go to Yard and Garden, and we have Ask a Master Gardener. You can enter in your question and submit up to 3 photos. Master Gardeners are ready to answer your questions.
Great website.
There's also a ton of information, too.
Yeah, extension.umn.edu. Another reminder, if you missed it, both Julie and John will be back next Saturday on our Smart Garden Show. So if you didn't get your question answered today, join us again next week. Julie and John, thanks so much. We will talk again next Saturday.
Thanks, Denny.
Thank you,
Always
Julie.
Always a lot of fun.
Thank you, John. Always is. Thanks for the information. Stay tuned next for our news break, and then Andy Lindis will be answering any kind of a home improvement question you might have on our home improvement show coming along next hour. By the way, our high today, we're going to only reach about 49 degrees. We drop again to 33 overnight, 61 with sunny skies tomorrow. We'll get you further details coming up. 32 now on CCO.